a girl just like. Skip train, don't gotta ride. All I got is my heart and my pride. Cash money for the game on the streets. The only way to hustle is to spit it on the beats. Don't fuck around. When I come through with the verse and the sound and the hacks and the biz, wanna box on my flow, but I don't give a fuck. I'm the shit and I know. Mama. Drama. Karma. Might hear me holla. I'm a girl just like what? I'm a girl just like.
Welcome back to the Hip Hop African Podcast. Today I'm super excited to have Dope St. Jude. So I'm going to give you a little bit about her background. I feel like a fangirl today because I've been like waiting to do this interview. And I remember seeing a picture of you with the Gap. And so it's called Mwanya in Swahili. And it's like, you know, so I'm like, okay. All right. Anyway. Okay. So Dope St. Jude is a South African hip hop artist who was born and raised in Cape Town, which is also the birthplace of South African hip hop. And she studied political science at the University of Cape Town, started her hip hop career as a drag performer, performing as St. Jude, resembling Lil Wayne. And I didn't know this until Adam Hawk told me, and I was just kind of like blown away by this, but he said that in the Real Talk video, there's a clip that I assume was Lil Wayne. And he said, no, that's her. And I had to kind of like go back and watch it. So if you see the Real Talk video, whoever you think that's actually her in drag. So that was awesome. As Dope St. Jude went on to release several singles, and then the first project, Reimagine, was released in 2016. Her second, Resilient, was released in 2018. Which included the song Girl Like, which really, really blew up, was an amazing song. Now, you also happen to be one of the most visible out queer African rap artists. And I know you feel the weight of that, but I guess I wanna start by asking, do you also feel that the industry has kind of tried to put you in an identity box because of that?
Firstly, I want to say thanks for having me on your podcast. I appreciate it. And I didn't know that. What is the name for Gap?
Mwanya.
Mwanya, yeah. That's something new. You learn something new every day. In terms of being felt like I was put into a box, yes, at times I definitely felt that. But at the same time, I also felt the responsibility, you know, of representing queer people in hip-hop, queer Africans, in hip hop. And I mean, while it was sometimes what's the word, like at times I didn't like being put into a box, I felt it could be quite limiting. You know, I think the feeling of the responsibility outweighed that. And so it almost felt like a bit of a selfless act. And I don't want to say martyrdom, like that isn't the right word, but something along those lines of like kind of giving up my own, like letting go of my ego and realizing that like what I'm doing kind of serves a greater purpose sometimes, like trying to think like that sometimes.
Okay. Now, I think we have seen just in general in hip hop, kind of more open attitudes and more kind of acceptance. And I think, you know, even, you know, initially it was towards women. And I think we've seen it, you know, and I don't want to give hip hop culture too much credit because there's so many examples of homophobia in hip hop, but there have been kind of these gradual kind of movements. You know, you have people like Lil Nas X who, you know, have kind of found mainstream success. But since you kind of started in 2011, have you seen changes within South African hip hop towards kind of accepting of kind of more queer voices in South African hip hop?
To be honest, I think there are changes, but they're quite small, you know. I think South Africa often follows slowly in terms of what's happening in the rest of the world, particularly when it comes to hip hop. Mm-hmm. And I think when we think about South African, when we speak about South African hip hop, we should think about the fact that there are different kind of schools of South African hip hop. There's the more kind of Americanized school of South African hip hop, which is, you know, like basically like the same kind of music and the same kind of beats, trap pop beats, trap hip hop beats that you hear from the US. And now you've got this new kind of South African hip hop that comes from sounds of Kwaito and Qom music. And that's a whole different side of the coin, you know? And within the more like African vernacular hip hop, we're starting to see artists like Shoma Jozi, who's a Qom artist but also a rapper, who may I'm not sure she identifies as queer herself. I'm not sure, but I know that in her music videos she embraces a lot of kind of queer imagery. And she's a mainstream artist right now. So that's like, it's cool to see like those kind of visuals coming out. You have an artist named Moonchild Sunnily, who is also a Qom singer and kind of collaborates with hip hop artists. And she's very sex positive. So it's nice to see in the South African mainstream, like maybe not a step towards like, being completely queer or accepting of queer hip hop artists, but definitely kind of a step in a more sex positive direction for women particularly, and more agency over sexuality than we've seen before.
Okay. Yeah. And that's, I mean, another thing I think in your music that in playing some of, because the first song that I heard of yours was Real Talk. And so I think there were just so many layers in it. And when you talk of kind of sex positivity, that there were so many layers that were so unapologetic, and it was just very unambiguous. It was not coded. It was, and so one of the things that I loved about the song and why I kind of love sharing it in classes was because it addressed so many contradictions, and just kind of, just in some of the lines, like, you know, I got five guys and they're all my side bitches, and just kind of just a line like that. And so the students at first assumed, oh, well, yeah, she's a player. I'm like, no, like, that's not, it's not like, it's not. So in just in terms of understanding kind of the context and everything, you know, the entire song, and understanding one, this the use of slang, and then understanding kind of your identity and just everything in it and kind of how it spoke to so much more than that. And so one of the things that also brought to that was brought to my that kind of resonated with me in that song is your kind of criticism of feminism. And so one of the lines in the song says, "Your brand of feminism to my world is so outdated. Please update it for the rappers, for the fly girls, for the girls who like to fuck, for the sisters, for the mothers." So what is your view on feminism, whether it be African feminisms or other feminism, and how has it been influenced, or how was it influenced by your studies at UCT?
Well, that's quite a difficult question, because I think about that all the time. And I think that my idea of feminism is that it's constantly developing, first of all. Like, it's there is no one kind of feminism. And I very much believe in intersectional feminism that accounts for different lived experiences, and that we can't separate one struggle from the other. And then also, I think that feminism is like quite nuanced and specific to different groups of people. I think that it's easy for like for us as critical thinkers or people in the academic world to want to have a blanket kind of feminism for one group of people, like Black, so maybe like Black African feminism. And you know, it's different, like so the experience of Black South African women, and then within that group, colored women is very, like, it's different to someone, to black women in a different part of the continent, you know? So, honestly, I don't know how to define it. I think I am still kind of navigating, like, what it means to me. And I think that's what I was trying to explain in the song, is like this frustration of like feminism not accounting for the single mothers, or for people in different, you know, people who come from different kinds of struggles, for trans women. I was more about voicing that. And I think how UCT affected that was, I think it just gave me like an ability, like being at university gave me the chance to be a critical thinker, but also not to just accept things the way they are and to question. And I think that's the point of getting into any kind of academic mm-hmm. program, especially in the social sciences, is like we should be questioning things. And so I think that's how UCT kind of played into that.
Because I, you know, one of the, when I was looking at doing an article on hip hop, feminism in African hip hop, one of the things in interviewing several artists is so many women did not rejected the feminist label. And a lot of them, they associated it with this kind of academia, respectability politics, and they wanted no parts of it. And so they were like, I'm not a feminist. And so, but as I'm listening to the songs and they're like, you know, ripping patriarchy apart and smashing like, you know, misogyny. And I'm just like, but this is, and so, and it was, you know, but then I'm also kind of looking at how these new kind of attempts, again, academia always, I think one of the academics can't help themselves. They always want to brand something. And so you have like, you know, hip-hop feminism. And now the new one is ratchet feminism. It's like,
is this like Cardi B, Megan Thee Stallion and all of that?
Exactly. So it's this attempt to say, okay, you know, this is a new kind of voice. And so it's, you know, I've kind of tried to stay away from trying to brand this, you know, sort of feminism that African women who are involved in hip hop, you know, kind of speak to, but just to kind of say that there are feminist voices that are addressing patriarchy, that are addressing misogyny, that are sex positive in many ways. In some ways, not necessarily, not all women in hip hop are sex positive, and not all of them are accepting of, you know, different gender identities and sexualities, but that they do often present just by being in that masculine space, that they are in many ways challenging patriarchy. And so
yes, that
in its own self is important and valid. But yeah, it's so, like you said, very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I think that like at the end of the day, if I can make like a, like if I was to make a kind of a blanket and a statement about what I think feminism is, I would say that it's allowing women to be empowered in whichever way they feel like that empowerment takes its form. So whether that's in being sex positive or making a song like Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion did, if they feel empowered by that, mm-hmm. And they're searching for some kind of equality, like by doing that, then who are we to say that isn't feminism, you know? Like I think by trying to label feminism, saying this isn't, like that in itself is anti-feminist, because we should be able to define what feminism is, like to everyone should be able to define what it means to them and what makes them feel empowered. And we all express our disdain or we smash the patriarchy in different ways, you know. Some people do it through expressing their sexuality, having agency over their sexuality, and some people do it, I don't know, through like burning bras, mm-hmm. or being a suffragette in the olden days. We don't know, like there's just a different we should just allow women mm-hmm. to explore and navigate what it means to them.
Do you find that kind of the, as an artist, that it's difficult, or have you felt the difficulty, or that there is any difficulty in terms of navigating your sexuality when the industry often wants to make it a commodity? Because, you know, one of the things that was interesting with the Megan Thee Stallion Cardi B song, I think that, you know, it, and again, it becomes kind of sometimes difficult because on one hand you're like, okay, you know, you're looking at sex positivity, but then when you kind of look at the authors or the who writes the lyrics, and so if you find a song that, you know, is celebrating female sexuality or sexuality, and it's written primarily by men, then it's like, so and we know that there are women who are pressured into centering their sexuality in a certain way because that's what is marketable. So I guess, how do you kind of navigate that? And have you felt that pressure at all to kind of center your sexuality, maybe in ways that you don't feel comfortable?
No, I haven't felt that pressure at all, but I do have experience of working with men, like working with a lot of men, especially in the production process and in the writing process, like Girl Like. I wrote the lyrics myself, but the song was produced by a man, a white man actually, and we had a lot of conversations, and I actually worked with him for my album, which I've recorded the demo recently, and you know, that is kind of like a difficult, I mean, I can't speak for Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion. I have no idea what happened in their studio spaces, who was writing, what kind of conversations were had. But I know that when I have these interactions, like I never leave feeling disempowered. I always feel like I have, like if we had a disagreement or anything, that I stood my ground. Not to say that the process is we have a lot of disagreements in the process, not at all, but I always feel like I'm heard and I feel respected, and I make sure that I don't have anything finalized that I'm not comfortable with. And I think that is quite important as an artist, and especially as a woman artist working in a field that is dominated by men. Because, you know, whether we like it or not, like the way the industry is set up, it is a boys' club right now. There are women kind of slowly getting into production spaces, but for the most part, my experience is that it's easier to find a guy producer than it is to find a woman or even a black woman producer. So I think it's just important for me, at least, to make sure that I'm heard and that my say is the final say at the end of the day. Yeah, I think, like, I mean, that's how I've been navigating the world. And I never feel like my sexuality is, I've never felt like forced. In the beginning I did, when I worked with kind of producers, garage producers in my neighborhood, they'd always say, oh, you should be more like Nicki Minaj, you know? And then I quickly moved away from people who didn't value me for the things that I thought were important to me. And I found the right people who valued the things that I find important. The only pressure I feel of my sexuality is the pressure I put on myself. To be quite honest, now that I'm getting older, I feel like I want to express my sexuality more in my music and in my visuals. I'd like to be or present a more kind of a sexier side, because that's something interesting to also explore artistically. Mm-hmm. So that's only ever come from me. It hasn't come from anyone else.
Okay. Okay. I think visually, a lot of your, even just the photographs that you've taken, and I know that over the years they've had to have been taken by different photographers, but there seems to be a very similar kind of vision, not vision, but like they're different, but just in terms of they all kind of have this unique story that they seem to be telling. And it's like your personality, your kind of artistic vision seems to shine through in the images that I've seen of you over the years, even though they've been taken by different photographers. So it seems like there's some kind of a positive collaboration between yourself and whoever's taking the pictures. So that shows definitely.
Yeah, like you said, I think the important word you use was collaboration. Like even when you're taking photos, it's a collaboration, which means that like both of our visions should be met. And if there's a compromise, if we come to a compromise, it should be like an equal compromise where both parties feel happy and satisfied. And I think that's why there's this kind of golden thread in all of the imagery, is because I always make sure that I get what I want, or like the best version of what I want from the project.
Okay. Now you also deal with race and colorism in your music. And I know the videos and song lyrics for songs like Brown Bass and Girl Like and Inside address issues, you know, dealing with women and their hair, skin color, beauty standards. And I remember when we met in Cape Town a few years ago, you kind of talked a little bit about your experiences growing up and how that influenced your own views. And it comes through in the lyrics in your song. Can you kind of talk a little bit about how, I guess, your own personal experiences have impacted your views on, you know, color and beauty and all of those things?
You know, I don't think I'm unique at all in my experiences. I think it's like quite universal, especially like most definitely for Black women who have had to experience colorism and what's it? I don't know what do you call it with hair? Is it texturism? is there a word like that?
Well. But I understand what you mean, so it definitely could be. Yeah, texturism might.
Yeah, and I mean, and then all the other things that come along with that, like when you like, for example, with education, like being educated in South Africa, coming from a poor neighborhood, and then having to go to a wealthy school, I realize, especially through my music and meeting people who resonate with my music, that my experience is not unique at all, and in fact isn't only unique to a South African experience. Like I've met people in France who could resonate with what I said, you know, and like find some kind of like solace in the music. Yeah, so my experiences growing up in Cape Town, obviously it's Cape Town's in South Africa, and South Africa is just coming out of apartheid. I think it's been about, 26 years now that we've been technically out of apartheid, but still economically there's been no change of like power hasn't really changed economically. Black people continue to live in impoverished areas and continue to be a disenfranchised group. So I mean, growing up in that context as someone who's colored, and by colored I mean in South African context mixed race, and typically coming from a generations of mixed race people, I come from I don't come from generations of mixed race people. So I come from I have a Black parent, a Black grandmother, and Black cousins. I just wanted to, as an asterisk to this whole conversation, I do identify as Black, but within the South African context, I identify as colored. I just want to say that. So that definitely informed the way I see the world. And now, having moved to London, having moved to the UK, and understanding my Blackness in a different context, has been enlightening and has definitely kind of informed just a more in-depth understanding of the struggle of Black people, of queer people, of African people. And so that's also why I say it's like intersectional, because I it just like exposes to me more and more every day how everything is kind of tied into each other. You know, like when I come here to the UK, you know, as South Africans, we don't realize the privilege we have. South Africa is like a lot more privileged than other African African nations. So when I come to the UK, I'm stripped of my privilege of being a South African in the African context. Yeah. And I'm just African, right? When I travel in Europe and I perform and I'm not in my performance spaces and I go visit a restaurant, people ask me where I'm from. I say I'm from South Africa. I'm not, like, people don't know the difference between South Africa and Rwanda, for example. I'm just African. At the border, I'm just African. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting to understand myself in that way. And mm-hmm. I'm thankful for it. I'm thankful that I'm able to travel. And at the same time, I don't know if this is the right word, but I do mourn my ignorance a little bit.
Yeah,
because it was safer in my ignorance. And I think that's what, when we spoke about denial earlier before we started the podcast, the denial of privileged groups, mm-hmm. like I can understand that sometimes it's easier to sit in your ignorance and experience the world simplistically instead of having to engage with, like, what it really means to suffer in the world, you know. But I am grateful that I am aware and that I have this knowledge now.
Okay. And I think South Africa, there's so many interesting layers to like racial politics there. And I think Americans, I know for me, every time I've gone to South Africa and I think that I understand, I come away and I'm just like, okay, I just don't get it. And it's like the layers of kind of, you know, whether it be the experiences of people from other parts of Africa and South Africa, but then even kind of the identity of Black versus colored, because, you know, growing up in the States, even though I was born in Tanzania, growing up in the States, you kind of become, you know, indoctrinated into the kind of either Black or white. One drop of Black blood, you're Black, period. And so then when you see kind of this third option, it then, you know, you're kind of thought is that this is a choice and that this choice is because you don't want to be Black. And so then it comes, and I've kind of evolved from that. And so now I'm really, and a lot of that has been through conversations with Adam and Quentin, and they've really kind of, you know, especially Adam, he's really, we've had a lot of conversations about race and identity in South Africa and in Cape Town in general. But it's been really interesting kind of seeing that and understanding that and understanding how that has also played out in hip hop. Because I know there have been artists who are, you know, kind of like, who may have a colored identity in South Africa, but have embraced kind of this global Black identity. But then I've also heard artists from Southern Africa, whether they be from South Africa, but even some from places like, you know, Namibia or Botswana, who have kind of worn the flag of colored identity and kind of like in their lyrics, you know, so it's a very interesting thing, and it's hard to understand the nuance of all of that.
It is, and you know, I won't lie, like I definitely struggle with it, you know, because I understand the importance of identifying as colored, because even though it was a group that was kind of like first of all, I think that we should like kind of say first that white people defined all of these groups, Black and colored and all of this. Like, this was like kind of all for me from the perspective of white people naming all of these groups. So for me, even the naming of the groups for me is kind of flawed. But then colored people come from Malaysian slaves, and then also mixed race people, and they were basically people who weren't indigenous Black people to South Africa specifically, like they weren't Zulu or weren't Xhosa. And while I understand the importance, and I definitely resonate and understand colored culture, and I understand the importance of kind of carrying the colored flag, mm-hmm. Coloredness often comes with anti-blackness because colored people historically have been used as a pawn by the white government and have been used as kind of like the exceptional race against black people as being one step better than black people because they are maybe mixed with some more blood. And again, like this is, these are white people enforcing these rules. But from that, a culture evolved, the colored culture evolved, whether we like it or not. It came from that, like maybe it was a messed up origin, but there's still very much a strong colored culture, and we can't deny that it exists because there are kind of fundamental shared experiences that all colored people have. So for me, it's very difficult because I do identify as colored because I grew up in a colored community, but I understand the history of where it comes from, and I understand kind of like the anti-blackness sometimes that can be tied in with the colored community. So I'm wary sometimes of identifying as colored. I always feel like I need to kind of have an asterisk and say that I'm not anti-black, but I also know that as a colored person, I have more privilege in the South African context. So it's just so complicated, and so this is why also I guess like having moved to the UK, it's kind of a bit of a breath of fresh air not having to deal with that. Like I'm just black here. I'm just African. Where at home there were lots of layers to it. And while it is beautiful, it does become complicated, especially when you come from a mixed race family like my family. So and I think I do talk about this in my music. And again, I don't think it's something that only South Africans experience. I think, like whether you in the US, there's some version of the story that is real for you, for black people in the US in some way, you know, when it comes to colorism, or someone has a cousin who has a white parent. I don't know, but I've seen it play out. Like a lot of people, even funny enough, like when I speak to Irish people, I had no idea about the issues that white people have within themselves. Because I just saw white people as like one big group, and now coming here, I'm realizing like all the beef between the Irish and the people in England and the Eastern Europeans. Like there's a version of the story. It almost seems like to be a part of the human condition that people want to other each other and create hierarchies. It's been fascinating.
And it's interesting, like African American culture. Like, you know, when you mentioned colored culture kind of evolving because of the social conditions, like African-American culture evolved in very much the same way. So you had like all of these, you know, kind of enslaved Africans, and then you threw in some European, you know, sexual assault into the picture and kind of blended it all up. And then you have, you know, kind of hundreds of years of experience that kind of really gave rise to a whole culture that is based off of all of that. So very much a similar way to kind of, you know, when you look at the culture within colored communities in South Africa. So very, very interesting. So in terms of your move to the UK, I know you get a lot of love in Europe, and I know that in terms of your experiences, in terms of performances and fan bases, but what has been the reaction among, or reception, I guess, among the South African diaspora in Europe? And it's kind of also going back to, and I think this is probably why, because when you probably answered my question, but I noticed that there are not, compared to like other countries in Africa, there are not as many South Africans living abroad. Like, I'm always surprised that, and maybe it's because of what you kind of just said. It's like why there's a lot of comforts in South Africa. And so, but has there kind of been any kind of interesting interactions with the diaspora, the South African diaspora?
Not really, because I think like the majority of my fans in South Africa were queer people or people who were kind of just under, like, who understood why I moved. And I think, like, the reason I moved was because, obviously, my biggest fan base is outside of South Africa, and also because that's where the money is for me, is outside of South Africa. Unfortunately, I don't believe that I could have really kind of capitalized on my career as much as in South Africa as I could in Europe. And I mean, ever since I moved to the side of the world, my songs have kind of, like, I've been able to have my songs play on Apple TV adverts and in Renault adverts all around France. McDonald's picked up my song for an advert, and I just don't think that I would have had that kind of response. And honestly, mostly for me, it was the money. Like, I just don't think I would have been able to earn that amount in South Africa. I would have had to come to terms with being kind of a struggling artist. I don't know if South Africa is ready for someone who's as unapologetically queer as I am, you know, isn't ambiguous about their queerness. Because I think right now, like, there are a lot of artists maybe who are kind of, like, ambiguous about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. And it's and while I would like to kind of thrive back home, I just don't think, I think it would have taken time. Mm-hmm. I think South Africa maybe could have accepted a queer hip hop artist, but I think it would have taken me much longer. And and I want to buy a house, you know, I want to go home and buy a house in Cape Town. So yeah, I just kind of, like, I just made a calculated move and came here.
All right. So in the last couple of questions, in terms of, we talked a lot about before the interview started, the 2020 and kind of what we're all going through. So with everything happening in 2020, especially the summer of 2020 and kind of this being kind of a historic year, how have you kind of, I guess, persevered? I don't know if the word is persevered, but managed, not just professionally, but also just kind of spiritually, because I think that it's easy to just kind of, you know, when you have people like Michelle Obama talking about battling depression because of all of this, it's, you know, it's definitely, yeah. So how have you kind of just maintained positivity and just kind of gotten through with everything that's going on?
Okay, to be honest, something that was really important for me at the beginning of the pandemic, I guess after the first month, because we've been at home for about almost 6 months now, right? Mm-hmm. And I spent about 3 months off social media, which I think a lot of artists probably wouldn't do, because there was kind of this pressure that we should maintain contact with our audience, which I totally respect and understand. But there was this pressure for artists to, like, continue producing at the same pace that they would, if not more, like, during the pandemic. And not only for artists, but, like, everyone, we suddenly became kind of very locked onto our phones, like, engaging with the news, engaging with each other, because we weren't seeing each other in person. And to be honest, like, I found that a bit overwhelming. And I think what really saved me in this time was taking a bit of a break off social media. Gave me a lot of clarity. I still listened to the news. I still watched and followed what was happening in the news, but sporadically. I didn't have it, like, constantly in my face. So for me, it was that. And also finding a routine, meditating, like finding a kind of daily routine and finding joy in simple things like gardening. I started gardening. I know everyone has their own approach to dealing with their mental health, and I found something that worked for me, but I took the time to do it. And I think sometimes we don't, because we're distracted by social media and all of these things, we don't take the time to figure out really what our routine or what our healing process is. So I don't think that getting off social media necessarily is the answer, but I think what it did for me was give me time to reflect and to figure out for myself what I needed. And I think that's what I would encourage people to do, is to make the time and to prioritize themselves and make the time to figure out like what it is that they need in order to cope in these difficult times.
And so lastly, what are you looking forward to in 2021?
Wow. I am looking forward to hopefully some peace, some more peace in the world. I'm really hoping that things end up better for the US. Mm-hmm. Because I think because the US is kind of like they're so prominent in the media, like those kind of vibrations and their frequencies affect the rest of us in the world, you know? Yeah. So I really hope for peace there, and I hope for peace in the rest of the world. And I am looking forward to things opening up again, and I'm looking forward to people engaging in a more meaningful way and with more intention after this pandemic, because I think that this lockdown has given us some pause, and I'm hoping and looking forward to the positive consequences or repercussions of that pause. I want to see people engaging more thoughtfully, and I'm looking forward to that. And personally for myself, I'm looking forward to releasing my debut album. I've never released an album yet, so I'm excited for that. And yeah, I'm just I'm looking forward to things getting better, ultimately. And you, what are you looking forward to?
Oh, I travel.
Traveling.
Mm-hmm. I was supposed to be on the continent this summer, and I just, I miss Africa. I'm really hoping to be able to go this summer. Next summer, summer 2021. And also being back in the classroom, because teaching virtually, it's just, it's not the same.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I really want to see the students. But teaching at a historically Black college has been great. I mean, some of the class sessions end up being like therapy sessions, you know, where we just talk about being Black and just kind of what that means, especially after something happens, you know, the Chadwick Boseman thing, you know, we come to class, we talk about what that means, and just, yeah, so it's, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking forward to. But yeah, I'm also definitely, when your album comes out, I'm also looking forward to that. I'm definitely going to be, we'll have all your social media stuff and your website on the show notes. But I definitely want to thank you so much for coming on. And I'm so happy I got a chance to interview you for the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm also very thankful for what you sent me before the show. You sent me some of the writing, some of your students, and that was really, it was something to read it. It made me feel like what I do isn't lost, because it's easy to feel hopeless, especially in these times. So it really kind of inspired me, and I read it around the time I was recording my project. And so their words definitely inspired me and made me feel something.
Good. Every year that I teach that class, the students, you know, several students choose South Africa to focus on. And every year, and I never say, you know, write about her, but every year they seem to gravitate, students who choose South Africa always seem to gravitate towards your work. But the very first student who made me aware of your work, she is, you know, she's a queer identifying student, and she was just, you know, she became an immediate fangirl and was super, super excited when I told her I had met you. She was just like, yeah, she was, she actually recently got engaged to her partner. So, she had
amazing
Instagram and everything. Yeah. So Yeah, no, it was definitely very, very influential. So yeah, continue. I mean, I don't even have to encourage you to continue. You're just awesome. And yeah, so
thank you.
I just got a boost of fire, knocking out another Naya, cause the power take me higher, so I'm spitting through the wire. Ask your girl, cause she a liar, if she said you're doing good. We ate at last night for dinner, and then later had some food. I'm a boss, I'm a queen, I'm the black slave's dream. I'm the king, I'm the power, tell myself this every hour. If you weak, you need the power, if you small, you want a tower. Let me feed this budding flower, cause I'm blessed, I'll never cower. It's the hour to be bold, will you play or will you fold? Throwing shade to make you cold, buy your shit before it's sold. Your aesthetic's getting old, and your style is too defensive, and you're trying to hold me back when you know my shit's progressive, and you know I'm cock impressive, and you're always having fights. Straight boys, gay boys, all turning into dykes, and I'm reaching crazy heights, and I reached a crazy low.